Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. This episode is brought to you by our partners at the Official Outlander Store. Be sure to check out their site for official Outlander merchandise, including the incredibly popular Funko Pop figures. Go to outlanderpod.com and click on the link to the Outlander Official Store. Welcome to episode 113 of the Outlander Podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. This week we are discussing chapter 27, entitled An Audience with His Majesty. Again, super excited. It's a title I can actually read.
And apparently we're being visited this week again by one of my Shah.
You don't pronounce that T?
We're still in France, so it's Shah. Shah, sorry. Shah. Le Shah, Le Shah, Des Shah. And that's spelled C-H-A-T-S.
Le Chat Noir. I had that painting.
Oh, you still have it?
It was a puzzle I put together. It was cheaper than buying the print.
It was so a puzzle. You worked for it.
Yeah, it was a puzzle. I bought it, I put it together, I glued it, and then I promptly lost it. High five me.
Doing a move, I'm sure.
I've moved so many times.
So in my notes, I have the notes about the correct chapter, but I have the little entree where we say in our episode, in this episode we continue our dragonfly number. This is the part that I put in all the description. I have chapter 27, Fontainebleau.
Nope.
So what is
but
it again?
But they are it.
They are at
an audience, an audience with his majesty.
There you go.
And it starts at Fontainebleau.
Yes.
Blue.
So, they are at Fontainebleau. Claire continues to heal, and she is summoned by a maid. She has a visitor, and that visitor ends up being Magnus.
That's not even a French name, is it? Magnus?
Well, it's Latin, technically. It means great or big. Magnus has brought I almost said Broughton. Oh my gosh, that's embarrassing. So Magnus has brought a letter that was addressed to Claire that had actually been received by the household 2 weeks prior. And Jamie...
I just realized I didn't check the mail today.
Do you want to go do that right now?
No.
Okay, good. You might want to do it before we go to bed.
Yes.
Before you go to bed.
That.
Because there will be no we going to bed.
Nope.
So she finds out, with surprise, and she's shocked, that Jamie had been gone these 2 weeks, and that's why they had kept the letter. They were trying to figure out, you know, what do we do with this letter? Because it was addressed to her, because Jamie figured there was less of a chance for her mail to be basically poked and prodded and disrupted and read, whatever.
Which I think is strange, because there's as much...
Dame Blanche?
Yeah, like all the stuff surrounding her is just as scandalous as the things surrounding him.
Yes, but maybe not, but not political in nature. So probably the people who are looking to look through his mail might not be the same who would look through her mail. And since Jamie has scared them off because of La Dame Blanche, they may not want to touch it also for that reason, in case they are of the political nature.
I prefer the probably.
Oh, well, I may leave that in. We'll see. Okay. It didn't make sense that he would have left before receiving the letter, because the whole purpose of that letter was to get the date the ship was leaving from Orvieto.
Lisbon
to Orvieto. It seems basically everyone but Claire knows about Jamie. Here Claire's like, wait, there's a letter and Jamie's been gone? No, that's not possible.
She assumed he'd already gone.
That's what freaked her out.
He was already on the boat and with Myrta and doing the whole...
slow boat to China.
Is that a real song?
Maybe I have China wrong, but it is a song. We did it in jazz choir ages ago.
Decades.
Ages ago. Yeah, that's true. So, again, everyone but Claire seems to know about Jamie. He'd been arrested at the duel and taken to the Bastille.
Don't you hate that when people are like, it was for your best interest. I was thinking about you when didn't tell you this.
If my fake... Well, that was real for her. But if... Summer just cocked her head like, you're what?
I'm waiting. Fill it in.
If my fake Scottish 6'3", well, in the book, 4, redheaded, whatever, buff a lover of a husband, were disappeared, had disappeared, were taken away, and you didn't tell me?
Disappeared. You're fired.
I'd be incredibly upset if you hadn't shared that with me. Because, oh, you're healing. Oh, you lost a bit. Don't get me wrong. It's awful what she's, they both, but of course mostly her because she's the one literally losing the baby. But it's awful what she's gone through.
It is, but let her think that he was a douche.
Well, not just that. Okay, yes, but they let her think that he was actually doing the thing. Here's the thing. She may have thought he was a douche. And she could live with that because she was living with that.
And I picked douche because that's a French word, right?
It is actually. And it's also a German word, which from the French. Duschen.
Yeah.
Unter der Dusche.
I know.
Okay. Claire could and was living with possible douchery of Jamie.
Okay.
However, she was under the impression that his douchey self was on a ship headed for Orvieto.
Well, they allowed her to think that his douchey nature was to not have anything to do with his wife who was losing a baby put everything else ahead of that.
Not try and come see her at the
To be honest, he did put revenge in front of the well-being of his wife and child. We don't know why yet, but he put revenge against Captain Randall.
But isn't that part of under the column of douchery to her?
That's what I'm saying.
She doesn't know.
In her defense, that was douchey, and falling in line with that douchery would be him choosing to continue on with this whole let's thwart the uprising, and that's way more important than everything
else. My baby.
Right. So
it seems everyone but Claire's knows about Jamie.
Claire,
he'd been arrested at the duel and taken to the Bastille.
Oh, and BT Dubs, Blackjack Randall is not dead.
We don't know that yet.
At the end of
the chapter.
We know it right here.
Oh,
The duel didn't kill him.
Sorry. I haven't gotten there yet.
Okay.
It's only like 2 lines away, but you're right. So there's no sentence. She's like, okay, well, when does he get out? How long is he there? And she learns there's no sentence. It is, quote, at the king's pleasure, which is awful because it could go on forever, but it's also good because there may be a chance to pleasure the king.
It's true, but this whole chapter should have been called At the King's Pleasure.
Truly. Okay. Yeah, I have one more. I have actually wrote
that was
in
very
here.
French.
Did I do that?
Yeah.
I have one more suggestion for a title, but I think that's it right there. At the King's Pleasure. That's the title of the episode. It has to be, right?
It can be.
It has to be.
Either that or douche, because we've said that a lot too.
No. I'm not ever going to name it a recipe.
I wouldn't know how to make a douche. I don't have a recipe for a douche.
I would never name one of our episodes
that. But right now, it's a dash of Jamie.
Okay, so we also find out that Randall wasn't killed, and that if he had been, consequences would have been worse, meaning for Jamie. So Claire, overcome, verklempt, for everything, faints. She comes to, of course, in bed. Someone had taken her to bed. So Claire plans to get Jamie out of prison. She's like, look, something, you know, no matter how I feel about him or what's happened, there's the greater good, right? We've got to do this. But also, he's my husband. I don't want him to be in here, blah, blah, blah. So she plans to get Jamie out of prison and then ride like a bat out of hell with him to Spain on a horse or on horses or whatever. Louise insists that a physician, you're still healing. You just fainted out there in the hallway or at the place, whatever. We're going to have someone, what was that?
I don't know.
We're having a physician come look at you.
Well, I think that Louise was also put off by the fact that she knocked over the tray
the
of
candy.
Refreshments with the biscuits and chocolate.
She's like, something's wrong.
She's like, no one knocks over my chocolate.
Claire gives
There's
it
clearly
and says,
something wrong with you.
Claire gives it and says, okay, fine, we'll do that. But before the guy gets here, I want the maid to come help me dress. I got to look, you know, I got to be presentable. So she gets dressed with help and then asks the maid, nah, I don't like that pair of shoes. Let's get a different pair of shoes. And as she's going into the big armoire, she pushes her in there and locks the door behind her. And I love it. When push comes to shove, literally, her inner strength, her gut reactions are her Beecham core. She says, quote, neat job, Beecham. All this political intrigue is teaching you things they never dreamt of in nursing school. No doubt about it.
Splitical or all this political?
All this political.
Like this splitical.
All this political.
Okay.
And then...
But can we talk about she wanted the maid to bring her red, like, bright red shoes to go with her yellow dress.
Yeah, that was kind of funky town.
The maid looked at her quizzically, but went on with it, and that's when she, like, put her in the armoire like it was the gingerbread house, and she was going to cook the...
Oh, like the oven.
Yeah, thing. push the old lady in the oven and be done with it.
And then, never able to leave without a parting shot, she tells the maid to have the doctor look at the monkey, because...
he's got mange.
There you go.
But I was just more commenting about the monkey.
The monkey?
Than you.
We're back in the carriage with Claire. Now, remember how I pointed out a few things about carriages so far, right? She doesn't have a lot of luck in carriages, or... there's a lot of carriages in this book.
I wonder if Diana Gabaldon uses carriages the way that Hemingway used rain and water. They were always a...
shizzle happens, or really bad shizzle?
It was always
shizzle?
Like an element of foreboding. People always died when it rained. So maybe it's like bad news for her to get in a carriage.
We shall see. So Claire is still in a general funk, perhaps not still bedridden as she was in her depression immediately after the loss of her child, but she still refuses to truly come to the light, if you will. She won't face her demons, as the word demons has been used about her feelings and things she's running from or won't run from. And that's her prerogative. Diana writes, quote, "My feelings were in complete turmoil. I had no intention of examining them closely. It hurt too much. Grief was there, and a horrible sense of failure, and overall, the sense of betrayal, his and mine. He should never have gone to the Bois de Boulogne. I should never have gone after him." So she's considering that both of them played a part in causing the death of their child.
Yes and no. There's no guarantee that if she'd stayed in bed that day...
absolutely.
...that she would have kept the baby. That the baby would have continued on and thrived. There's also no guarantee that had... he not gone, that things wouldn't have ended differently. Like, if he hadn't called him out, like, the whole thing could have gone down in a whole different area. So, I mean, that's a lot of speculation.
It is, but if you take the focus off of what she's speculating about, right, what she's saying or what the quote is, and just look, take a step back and look at the development of Claire and her feelings and what she's even willing to contemplate or think about, it goes from... Jamie killed our baby, right? She was basically blaming it on him, because without him, she wouldn't have felt forced to go to the Bois. And
well, and also his
all this stuff.
The fact that he wasn't there.
Well,
and
yeah,
he just
exactly.
Was like, and that was felt to her like an admission of guilt. Like, well, he's not here because clearly he knows he effed up.
Yes, all of that together. But after she loses the baby, it's depression and loss, right? As you would feel. But her focus... it went from basically F you, Jamie. It was all focused on Jamie and it being his fault, what he did or didn't do, what brought about this.
Right, but if he'd been there, if he hadn't been arrested in the Bastille, he would have been at Claire's side. I believe that 100%.
Absolutely.
Had he been there the whole time when she was in the L'Hôpital, she might not have felt, I would say probably, but I don't know, she might not have felt all of that F you, Jamie, this is all your fault, that she's felt in the preceding chapters.
I don't disagree, but okay. All I'm looking at is what's in the text. All we know is she loses the baby, this tremendously damaging, sad, awful, horrible, I mean, what worse thing that can happen besides the loss of a child in whatever capacity? So we go from this awful thing that's happened, and in her mind, besides, at least from the text, what we see is besides the grief that we see she has, is... I don't even want to say necessarily hatred, but her anger and fury about Jamie. It is at least couched in some way as what you get from her is Jamie did this. Because of Jamie, Jamie didn't stab the baby, but Jamie's actions led to certain things and that led to us losing our baby. It goes from that in general to now she's still talking about betrayal. She's still talking about grief. She's still talking about turmoil, but she's saying both of us. So she has gone from grief and blaming Jamie, basically, to not developing, working with, that's the wrong term, living with, living in, holding on, jumping into, I don't know what the best term for, but dealing with the grief, owning it more, not being afraid to push away that depression, still feeling it, but she's progressed to now at least seeing that it wasn't all Jamie. They share. And yeah, it could have been maybe absolutely no one's fault. 100%. But now, at least, in her brain, in a carriage, she's offering up both possibilities. She's not just saying, damn you, Jamie, I never want to see you again. She's saying, both of us, both of us. And I thought that was an interesting step.
Well, I think that the acknowledgement of the fact that he didn't run away and he was being kept from her helped. Made a huge difference Absolutely. In her state of mind.
Yeah, I don't disagree. So the language used in this paragraph paints an image of someone in fear. The words used, such as fleeing, partner in crime, expose, grief, guilt, fled. The word fled, that tense is used twice, and then body of the victim. So all of this language is scary, negative. It's not pretty stuff. You know, fleeing. You don't flee something you're happy with. It's about getting away from something. And, again, in a carriage. So she is, in a way, emotionally trying, maybe not trying to flee as much, although she may want to, but in the carriage, she is kind of fleeing at least an area. She even has mock labor pains, similar to those she had had when she lost their child. But she can finally think outside of her immediate funk to realize that she needs to do a few things. Because knowing Jamie, you're right, this news has, like, helped her. It's not wonderful news, but it's helped her kind, I think, begin to turn that corner more. So physically, she's much better, but still healing. But emotionally is what she's needing to heal much more. So there's the Jamie situation. He's locked up. She thinks of him in Wentworth. Of course, she's having these comparisons. She can only imagine what he's going through mentally. And then there's Charles, the ship from Portugal. They cannot allow that shipment to come in for them to make that money. It's too risky. She can see outside of her own feelings to put the needs of others before hers. Quote, the stakes were too high to allow my own emotions any play. For the sake of the Scottish clans and the Highlands themselves, for Jamie's family and tenants at Lallybroch, for the thousands who would die at Culloden and in its aftermath, it had to be tried, and to try, Jamie would have to be free. But she needed help. So, off to the L'Hôpital. Which is interesting.
Like, follow the yellow brick road?
Off to the L'Hôpital. Off to the L'Hôpital.
You don't need to keep going.
Mother nuns and nuns nope. and nuns nope. and lots and nope. lots of nuns.
Stop. No.
You started it, girl.
I apologize. And I immediately regretted that.
That was funny, though. Okay. She says to L'Hôpital, right?
I would have said off to L'Hôpital des Anges.
That works. That works.
Way better.
You want to try it?
Nope.
Let me try it?
You can if you want, but I'm just saying that's what I would have done.
Wait. Now I'm like, have the other one in my head. Off to L'Hôpital des Anges.
Off to L'Hôpital des Anges.
Got it. Off to L'Hôpital des Anges.
Exactly.
Off to L'Hôpital des Anges.
Mine's way better than yours. It's still awful, but we should continue.
No, but mine was much easier because now I can't think about the syncopation or whatever.
I'm all about syncopation. That's not syncopated.
Okay. The funny thing is, yes, she mentions it. Well, interesting. Okay. Yes, she mentions it, and yes, she goes to L'Hôpital because that's the next scene, place we see.
Yes.
But later in this part of the chapter, we find out that she's actually already asked other people. By the time she's having the conversation with Mother Hildegard and Herr Gastmann, she's already said, yeah, so-and-so said this, so-and-so said that. I'm like, okay, so homegirl tells us at least she's going to the L'Hôpital. Going to the L'Hôpital des Anges. I can't do it.
Off to L'Hôpital des Anges.
I can't. You gotta do it, because I'm not.
That's all. I'm gonna keep. I'll keep syncopating it for you, but
I'm not getting it with okay.
Off to L'Hôpital des Anges.
Summer's clapping for me now, like I'm a six-year-old learning rhythm.
Hey, if that's what I gotta do, I'm here for you.
Oh my gosh. So, I'll bring it up again when it actually comes up, but you'll see. I thought it was interesting. Oh, she's at L'Hôpital. Yet further in down the conversation that happens at L'Hôpital, we find out she's talked to other people. I'm like, how did you do that? What, on the way in the carriage?
I mean, it was... We've already discussed the fact that it was a very long carriage ride.
Yeah. Okay. So, Claire's in the company of Mother Hildegard and Herr Gastmann. The latter basically all but says that Claire can get Jamie out, as long as the king obliges...
If she lets the king in?
It will... I was just going to say, but it will require some hanky-panky. But I think yours is funnier. And Mother is shocked. Claire
but
has
two shocked. Two.
Hold on. No, because she totally gives her the goodies. Yeah, she's like, let me help you. So Claire doesn't get it. And like one of my favorite lines from this chapter, quote, "The Nun and the Singing Master." And this is what I wrote. I think that's a title right there, "The Nun and the Singing Master." But after when we said earlier, that's better. "So the nun and the singing master exchanged looks in which horror at my naivete was mingled with the general reluctance to remedy it."
But I love the fact that she's more modern than they are, and she's the one that's naive.
Clueless. Oh, yeah,
she's
absolutely.
She's just like, what?
Yep. While Claire is contemplating how Jamie would feel about her lying with anyone, including the king, she thinks on their former trust that has now been broken and smashed and dashed and all that. Quote, "The thought made me remember the trust that had existed between us almost since the day of our marriage, and a sudden feeling of desolation swept over me. I shut my eyes for a moment, fighting illness, but the prospect had to be faced." That's the Indian.
You went to Indian food?
Yeah.
You didn't bring me any, like, leftovers?
Well, it was a buffet. I don't think they let you take away from the buffet.
They have buffets open at night?
Apparently, it was a nighttime buffet.
Most buffets are not. They're mostly usually lunch buffets. I'm super jealous. I mean, I can only make like one trip to a buffet, but
I only made one trip. I'm like, I can't.
Anyway.
The only other way was to involve a friend of high rank who might intercede on her behalf with the king. But since all of Paris knew of the duel and its scandalous nature, the brothel and all, there was no one she could rely on to do as much. She had even been to see Duvernay, who had recommended to wait for the scandal to die down. But she's like, we can't, you know, there's no time. We have to, like, get him now so we can go to Orvieto. And this is what I was talking about. She had already been to see Duvernay. When the heck? So I guess she went on her way in, like you said. She had time. She got to Paris. She made a trip with her friends and then went to see L'Hôpital, right?
I imagine.
Oh, there's another one. The Duke. Le Duc.
But she didn't go see him.
She talked to someone. It. So Claire had done a lot of travel before, after, at first.
But what it says is, likewise, the Duke of Sandringham, so bound by the delicate proprieties of diplomacy that he had dismissed his private secretary for only the appearance of involvement in scandal, was in no position to petition. She didn't say that she went and saw him. She just said he's in no position to petition. That's really hard to say.
Okay, then don't say it.
I already said it twice.
So she makes up her mind. It's all on her. She has to do the deed.
I mean, which is silly because she pretty much already said it was all on her as she was like, yeah. Take me to the hospital.
Mother Hildegard, showing just how great a friend she is, tells Gastmann Claire will stay with her and that he can send word with the time for the meeting if the king agrees. She says to Claire, quote, "After all, if you are really set up on this course, my dear friend, it may be a sin to assist you in committing immorality. Still, I will do it. I know that your reasons seem good to you, whatever they may be, and perhaps the sin will be outweighed by the grace of your friendship." And she says that she'll pray for her.
Okay, it's set upon this course, as opposed to set up on this course.
Oh, I wrote two words.
Yeah, I was like, I'm so confused, because that doesn't sound like the actual phrase.
English people, it's an important skill.
Well, when reading an English book, yes.
Well, that's the whole... We're not reading a French book.
But if we were, it would not be much help.
But we're not talking about French.
Mais oui.
As Claire is dressed for the day, the name of Mary of Magdalene comes to her mind. Or Matahari, she says. We get some delicious descriptions of Claire's dress. Not a lot of detail about the dress, but we get it's red silk, scarlet folds, and she's got on some white for purity, red for ... whatever this was.
Right. But I feel like she was putting on, it was almost like...
It was a armor.
Yeah. Like, she's like, I am dressing for this particular occasion. I need to give the outwardly...
Yeah.
Yeah. I need to give the outward appearance of virtue for my husband, but at the same time, he needs to know that I'm down for whatever needs to happen, if that's what you want. Because I want to leave here with my husband. Period.
Connie writes, "The robing of Claire in red silk was in stark contrast to the robing of the postulants when they were about to take their final vows as brides of Christ." Further, Sister Minerve is selected to help Claire get ready to meet the king, getting her all tarted up in red silk with ostrich feather and darkened brow and rouged lips.
Can we just talk about how funny it is that a nun
is tarting her up? Quote, "The feel of the feather on my lips tickled unbearably, exaggerating my tendency to break into unhinged giggles. Not hilarity, hysteria." When her dresser was finished, She went to give Claire a hand mirror, but Claire stopped her. She didn't want to look herself in the eye. I thought, that was quite telling. That is a...
Well, she knows exactly what she's on her way to go do, and she's not proud of it, but she's like,
I don't want to primp any more than I've already
have. Not even primp. She's like, I
can't look at myself in the eye, is what she's saying.
Yes, but she's like, I trust whatever you've done is going to be going to be necessary, and I don't need to have this memory.
Yeah, exactly. It's enough for me to see the dress on my body.
How would you spell that?
B-O-D-E-Y. E-H. In my, yeah.
In your yeah? Okay.
Okay, the next setting is on the steps of the palace.
Oh, God, seriously, every time.
As long as we have a palace, I have to do it.
I can't wait till we get back to Scotland.
I know, because it'll be the Lallybroch like we would on the steps of the palace.
Oh, no more Lallybroch.
That was fake Lallybroch. That was a SARS Lallybroch. That was not... Stars.
Okay, I thought you said SARS. Like
SARS kills people. SARS is a great network.
SARS has killed a lot of people in the course of their shows.
Well, I guess a lot of people on Spartacus.
The body count on SARS is pretty high. Oh,
that would be interesting. I can't do that podcast. It's too much work.
The body count podcast? Welcome to the body count podcast.
So Claire is led through many twists and turns to the king's apartments. Or appartement. Stop it! Louis. I hope we don't have that. Okay. Louis brings her into his chamber and tells her not to be afraid. He won't bite. She thinks, of course he is. He does this all the time. Of course he is what?
Syphilitic?
No. No, but I wrote...
I'm just saying, if he does it all the time in that era, he's probably syphilitic.
No, he does this type of thing all the time. Not just doing the deed, but bringing women in, wives of people. So they sit and they get down. Oh, he offers her wine and she drinks. And she's avoiding looking at the green chaise longue over there in the corner. Or away from them.
Or a chaise lounge, depending on who you're speaking to.
So they sit and they get down to business. Jamie's in the Bastille and needs to get out. As they talk, Louis is stroking her wrist. She smells his acrid smell and violets. The king takes her hand in both of his and traces the lines of her wedding ring, Jamie's ring. Connie writes, as the king contemplates Claire, she thinks about how he is an absolute ruler, and he has been since the age of 5, and can do anything he wants with Jamie.
Or Claire.
Or, for that matter, herself. Louis brings up Sandringham, and Claire realizes that since Jamie had turned down his offer of a pardon to return to Scotland and get him out of the way, that his pressing for Jamie's internment, or imprisonment, in the Bastille was at least a way to get him out, meaning to get Jamie out of the way and not pay too much for the pleasure for him doing that. She asks Louis if he took orders from the English. Of course, that gets a little response. She also reinforces that Jamie is not a Jacobite and how his public silence on the matter was because of the nature of business of his Jacobite cousin, Jared. Louis considers and says if he grants her request, Jamie'd have to leave France. She's all, see ya!
She's like, done.
Done and what done. Else? Where's the bed? Here are my thoughts.
No, where's the chaise? Get it right. There's no bed. It's just a big chaise.
Le lit du roi. The bed.
Okay.
Lee is bed.
All right.
He says he would ask for a small service, and she says yes and steals herself for what's to come, what she thinks to come. Louis whips off his gown, and she's weak in the knees, not out of, like, sexy time, but out of, like, oh my gosh, trying to gather the courage to do what she must. Then he takes her across to a door across the room. Quote, I had one moment of ice-cold clarity as he let go my hand to open the door. And she damns Jamie Fraser.
Like, that whole statement confused me. Because I'm like, what exactly does she think's on the other side of that door?
Exactly. I thought, does she have, like, some kind of foreknowledge of something going down? No. I figured it out. Because she's surprised when they enter the room, what she sees. Not what she expects at all. So she does not have any foreknowledge. She thinks that this is the door to, like, maybe not his bedchamber, but another chamber where the deed's gonna happen. And so she's like, okay, she's a little about to get real. This ice cold clarity. Oh my gosh, I'm about to do this with the king. damn you, Jamie, for putting me in this situation. That's what I believe, because we have no textual evidence that she has any knowledge of what is on the other side of that door.
I mean, none of us did.
None of us did.
And this is quite a left-hand turn. Hard left.
Yeah, the hardest left you could, like, ever, yeah. And the funny thing is, it's like, what do you do before you go into, like, a mock seance, satanic room, whatever? I take off my dressing gown. I mean, that would have made me think. No. And Connie agrees with us that Claire is on a different wavelength than the king, obviously, because she thinks something else is about to go down. Connie writes, Claire's thinking, oh boy, here it comes, and is mentally damning Jamie. But instead of turning toward the aforementioned velvet chaise, the king leads her to a door at the far side of the room.
But I wonder how surprised she was once that door opened.
I mean,
because he does everything with an audience.
So why not this?
The
room was lit only by many tiny oil lamps set in groups of five. I think five is surely some kind of...
It's got to be specific
magical
to something.
Number, yeah. And the room was round. There was a round table in the center. The people sitting at the table all wore hoods. So not everyone in the room wore a hood, but everyone sitting at the table wore a hood. Claire thinks to herself, quote, apparently I was a guest of honor. Connie writes, this is not what Claire expected. Why couldn't Louis have just wanted sex? I mean, she would have been out of there so much sooner, and she wouldn't have had to listen to that Leconte go on and on about his exegesis, about whatever he was trying to get out of trouble with. His, like, who knows how long of his rant.
Involved her remarkably less with history, which would have been a much quicker resolution, and we know Diana isn't all about quick resolutions.
Louis announces her as someone with great skill and reputation. Connie writes, Louis wants Claire to use her skill to do something.
But then he goes on and on about how these things are not acceptable now, maybe in my grandfather's time. But then he keeps going back to, this would be totally okay in my grandfather's time. We don't do that here. But please, La Dame Blanche, use your special powers.
Show me your thing.
And tell me which one of these people I should believe.
So someone comes and places a huge candle on the table, and the candle is covered in symbols akin to those she'd seen at Raymond's secret chamber. The king draws her attention to the Comte Saint-Germain and Master Raymond, who are both there, standing side by side, approximately 6 feet apart. Raymond, ever the frog, gave no hint he knew her. He's smart like that. But the Comte, as always, all in white, balked at seeing her.
That's a terrible idea for an outfit.
All white?
All white. I mean, you're just asking to, like, spill stuff on yourself. Especially in a society where they drink a lot of wine.
Connie points out, and Connie, I agree with you 100%. Connie writes, I hadn't noted that this was a practice of the Comte, him dressing all in white. Had you? I certainly had not. When it said all in white, I was like, oh, interesting. And then it was as usual. I thought, wait, the who? I didn't even, I totally missed that. Connie writes, reckon he will be all in white in the TV show? Oh, good question. I wonder if they keep that.
It could go either way. And the only reason I'll say that is because as far as the wedding
dress... Stanley Weber?
No. Let me finish. As far as the wedding dress was concerned, it would have been super simple to make it a brown wedding dress, which is what was in the book, but Terry Dresbach had envisioned this beautiful, like, pewter... autumnal gown, which was breathtaking, but not straight out of the book. So while they could very easily put him in all white, it's not necessarily something that has to happen.
Raymond, in his typical scruffy velvet robe, was as calm, she says, as a turbot on ice.
What's a turbot?
So a turbot's a fish, and Connie also provided us with a picture, and we found a link on Wikipedia, which we can share. It's a really flat fish, right?
Yeah, it looks like a flounder, but it doesn't look like it has all the eyes on the same side of its body. Like flounder. Flounder's delicious, by the way. I have a few fish I actually eat.
Louis tells her they were both accused of sorcery, witchcraft, etc., and their charges are read. Louis says both men have undertaken investigations into the writings of ancient philosophers, employed arts of divination, astrology, etc.
I know you said red, like they read it out loud, but for whatever reason, we just talked about white, and I was thought it was a color. And I was like, their charges are red.
Yes, because they're serious.
Yeah, for real. Like blood. Blood red.
And Connie points out that the charges extend from bestiality to profanation of the Holy Eucharist to sex on the altar. I mean, you got some balls if you're going to do that.
I mean, if you're going to go down with charges, those are some pretty awesome charges.
Connie also points out that the name of Du Carrefour comes up again, and that is true. We hear about the last person to be... Was he hanged or burned? The last person to be executed.
Definitely executed.
For witchcraft.
Yeah. Was it something like 20 years prior?
Yeah, it was 20 years ago.
Burned. Burned in Paris. Or Paris.
Claire learned she was brought there as the white lady, la dame blanche, who cannot lie, and can see the heart and soul of a man and may turn that truth to good or destruction.
So is this one of the few times she benefits from having a face of glass? A glass face?
Maybe. Each man stood within a pentagram drawn for them. She was to judge the truth of what was said.
Like, seriously, everything about this whole thing is profane.
Yeah, every bit.
They're like, we don't allow this, and this is something that was totally popular in my grandfather's time.
Allow me to do all this Kabbalah.
But I'm just going to go ahead and draw this pentagram here, and exactly. I'm going to have a dude stand in it, and then, you know, we're going to have him exactly six feet apart with another pentagram, and then, you know, he'll be in white, and he'll be in, you know, little Master Raymond outfit, and it's cool.
Two pentagrams are drawn with chalk on the Aubusson carpet.
On the carpet?
Mm-hmm.
That's terrible.
Quote, only a king would treat a genuine Aubusson with that kind of cavalier disregard.
Exactly.
And Connie shares some references for the Aubusson carpet rugs, she says, which she has previously seen mentioned in many historical and Regency novels. It's an ornate rug constructed in a flat tapestry weave, often in pastel colors. After Aubusson, a town in central France, were made. Another place for us to visit one day.
I'm just saying it screams of decadence. And to do that to a very expensive rug screams of, I'm the king and I don't care.
Connie writes, Claire is wishing Louis had just wanted her body instead of putting her in danger from the Comte's minions. And by minions, she is referring to...
Not little yellow people.
As Saint-Germain passes her to go stand in the pentagram, she says...
He says, I do not
basically,
work alone.
Don't forget, I do not work alone. Now, Claire has visions because she still believes he was involved in that gang that attacked him in the alley. She says she thinks she has visions of someone cutting off her nipples and burning Jared's warehouse.
That's pretty extreme, y'all.
It is.
I mean, that's pretty... I mean, was that common? Nipple cutting offers? People cutting your nipples off?
I don't think so. It's what this band or this gang did, apparently. As Saint-Germain begins to give his testimony, she thinks about the threat this man poses to her, her family, and their plans to help prevent Culloden. She knows there is a good chance that he was behind the masked men in the alley. Quote, I could see my nipples erect with fright, standing out boldly against the silk of my dress. And this is Ginger speaking now. My first thought was earlier she'd said she could imagine her nipples cut off by the band of Les Disciples du Mal, and now she's saying that her nipples were erect and bold and scared, and yeah, I just thought it was interesting to mention them twice. She whips out the name...
I was like, she whips out her nipples?
She whips out the name of Les Disciples du Mal to the Comte, and he freaks. Finally, the king becomes interested in the proceedings.
Because he was yawning prior to that.
He was yawning.
He's like, yawn. It's like when Claire starts reciting the rosary to that dude to prove that she's not a witch. He's like, dude, just stop. I don't think you're a witch. Just stop reciting the rosary, please.
Connie writes, this shakes the Comte, who declares, quote, this woman lies. She is no true white lady, but the servant of Satan in league with her master, the notorious sorcerer, Du Carrefour's apprentice. Of course, he points dramatically at Master Raymond.
And we only know about that connection because of the dude she prayed, that prayed for her, the guy she ran into that was being fed by the... Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Lecon fights back with words.
And a snake in his pocket.
He pulls a snake from out of his pocket and says, "The Bible says they shall handle serpents unharmed." And he intends to prove this.
Because of course he does. Who doesn't carry a snake in his pocket? Like, for real.
Raymond interrupts by saying, "That is not all the Bible says." And he whips out a small cup and a flask. Quote, "And if they drink any deadly poison, they shall not die. The cup has a silver lining." He got permission for them all to drink from the king. And then he poured the liquid.
But can we go back to the snake for a second?
Oh, yeah.
Because for real, I carry a lot of things in my purse just in case. I do not carry a snake. Because reasons.
Because it's a snake.
Well, it's a snake. I'm just saying, it's just another random. Another
animal you don't want to have to take care of. Well, your snake would eat your ginny.
Forget all of that. I'm talking about my purse. Like, in my on my body at all times.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's random. And who would think I might need this snake? I'm going to carry this in my purse and with me at all times. Like I could make sense of, I need my debit card. I never know if I'm not going to have enough cash to make this transaction. I don't think I may need this snake because somebody may accuse me of trafficking in witchcraft. And I may need to prove, because of the Bible, that I am not afraid of snakes.
Connie writes, "Now in the Bible verse off, Master Raymond goes one better by quoting, 'And if they drink any deadly poison, they shall not die.'" She writes, "Reminds me of Willie and the Priest in episode 7 from the Star Stories." That was funny. Jinx, you owe me a Coke or a Diet Coke in Scotland next year. Master Raymond must have been a Boy Scout, Connie writes, because he has come prepared with a flask and a silver-lined cup, which he fills with an amber liquid, which at once turns red and begins to bubble.
Right.
Dragon's blood.
He's like, I see your snake, and I'll raise you some poison, because I always carry this with me.
Shazam. And this, of course, the reader will hearken back to that time when they were in Raymond's little store's secret room area.
Mm-hmm.
And he shows her... He gives her that crystal, and she's wearing the crystal, right?
Yes.
Beware of poison or whatever, to protect her from poison.
Can I go on to say that I really still don't understand how that crystal works?
So Claire drinks first, and then Raymond, and then she carries the cup to Saint-Germain. Claire thinks to herself, "Could I have stopped it? I asked myself 100 times, 1,000 times later. Could I have done otherwise?" She's wearing that crystal that Raymond had given her. She knew the cup was poison. Saint-Germain takes the cup and drinks from it, looking at her all the while. And then he falls down.
Deed. He falls down very dramatically.
Deed.
Dead. My point is that she says, "I didn't need the crystal."
Mm-hmm.
But again, I hearken back to my question of, I don't understand how the crystal would be able to know whether or not there was poison present. I'm trying to imagine what is the specific element in all poisons that would react with some sort of a crystal? I mean, is this a magic thing that I'm just supposed to accept for being magic, or is this like an actual scientific thing?
No, I was trying to remember back, and I did not go back and look, but I was trying to remember back. Okay, you have this crystal that's supposed to protect her. Okay, it's magic, it's whatever it is. She didn't do anything with it. No. I'm guessing just the wearing of it is supposed to. So when they were at his store, at his shop, at his secret room, whatever, didn't he do a demonstration of the dragon's blood? And didn't he talk about something with a silver lined chalice or something? There was some information or education done there. And so what I'm trying to think of is, if it killed Saint-Germain, but didn't kill the two of them.
It was not in the cup before she took it over to him. That was what was made very clear to me. He added it after both of them drank.
That's why he had her drink first.
Yes.
Because if he had done it and given it to her, she would have taken it.
Right, and I wonder whether or not it was like the iocane powder in Princess Bride, where he's like, I built up a tolerance to it.
That's funny.
Over the years. But clearly whatever he added to that cup between her drinking it, him drinking it, and then that cup being transferred to LeConte, it was not in there when they were drinking it. At least not when Claire was drinking it, because the only thing she's built up a tolerance to is Scott's.
I was about to say, it's like Jamie. Well, I'm glad you said that, because I was thinking, how was there... This is what I was thinking, because obviously I was too dull to think otherwise. I was thinking he poured something in the cup.
Mm.
She drank first, so whatever was in there, you know, just she got quickly what it was, like the pure substance. And he drank and got almost a pure substance, but that maybe there was a reaction that took a certain amount of time to take place, and the dragon's blood or the stuff, whatever it was, reacted with the silver in the cup.
I thought maybe it was something that was, like, in his mouth. Like, he, like, when he went to take his drink of whatever, like...
Like that poison tooth from Dune?
All of it. Yeah, for real. We're just going to make all kinds of movie and other novel references right now.
So that's kind of the chapter.
That is. That is absolutely chapter 27. Our next episode, we will be discussing chapter 28, entitled The Coming of the Light.
Carol Ann!
Okay, Poltergeist. Do you know there's a new Poltergeist? They made it.
I don't know how I feel about that.
All I know is somehow they've made the clown creepier.
Ugh, girl.
I know, and that was the worst part.
I would avoid it just for the clown. Well, the worst part is that little girl almost died.
I know.
But as far as being... the worst part is that movie was cursed. In real life, cursed.
Oh, yeah, for real. I do kind of want to see it just for nostalgia's sake.
I don't know if I could. The old one or the new one?
The new one. I've seen the old one, like, repeatedly.
But you want to know something I learned from that movie?
Don't have a clown stuffed animal in your room?
No.
The lightning, yes! Counting how many seconds.
I retain
how
that.
How far away. I do have that as well.
And it's also, lightning and then thunder, right?
Thunder then lightning. I think it's thunder and then you look for the crash of lightning. You're right. It's lightning first.
Lightning's it is light. Lightning first. It's not a crash.
Yes, it is lightning first. I also learned... that swimming pools are scary because there are dead bodies in them, and that trees will eat you.
Or just be very, very friendly, like in The Last Unicorn, where Schmendrick gets tied to a tree who he makes magically come alive, and it turns into a woman.
He flirts on that tree. Blah, 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 blah. He flirts with that tree.
Yeah, and he
Tree in Poltergeist was not into flirting. It was into eating.
What, did it, like, move?
It literally reached into the room
and started broke the window?
Oh, yeah, and started to eat the kid. Okay, I remember that.
Okay, enough of Poltergeist. Yeah, I may or may not see it, but I'm
going to make you watch it with me.
Never. The only thing I love to watch... I won't hold your hand,
but I'll tie you to a chair and make you watch it with me.
I don't ever want to hold your hand.
That's a lie.
That's not a lie.
It's a lie. She holds my hand. She's holding it right now. Don't lie. Stop it. Let go of my hand.
The only thing that we do together every year, movie-wise, is Love Actually.
It's true, but maybe now we do. But maybe now it needs to be Poltergeist and then Love Actually. Like Poltergeist right around Halloween and then Love Actually at Thanksgiving.
I'm just too... What's the word?
I don't know, but you're making a Grinch face right now.
When you're easily influenced, too easily influenced? If I watch that, I'll just have nightmares.
Susceptible?
I don't know, because that's like getting a disease or something.
Suggestionable?
That's not even a word.
Sure it is.
I mean, you can make it a word.
I just did.
Okay.
Again, next episode. Come on back. We'll be disgusting. Disgusting? We're always disgusting. But we will be discussing.
Hopefully not disgusting.
Well, there'll be less Poltergeist talk. Chapter 28, The Coming of the Light.
So thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/outlanderpod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/outlanderpod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.